Oh, fare thee well, I'm traveling on, Bob Dylan sings. And last Sunday, that's where we left things off in John chapter 6, Jesus' tough teaching. He's wildly popular, but suddenly a great many followers are saying, fare thee well, Jesus, I'm moving on. This week is our final week at the trailhead of the path I call compelling. And next week, we're going to jump onto the path itself, make our way into the caves of incarnation as we move into the Advent season. But for this final week at the trailhead, you could say, I simply want to ask and provide a response to three questions about this Jesus path. First, why is it that the Jesus path compels some but not others? It's all a bit of a mystery, but second, how do we know when we've encountered Jesus on the path? And third, who is this Jesus path for? Let's jump in. In the first week of the series, I made a case that we all need a path to follow in life. And last week, I made the case that more than that, we need a compelling path to follow. Fair enough. Again, in the story of John 6, the Jesus path represents a major fork in the road for many followers. And for many, the scene in John 6 represents this turning point, this fork in the road. Many people, they abandoned the Jesus path in the moment. For Peter and others, though, in that moment, confused as they were, all they knew is that in Jesus they sensed life and vitality. So despite their confusion, Peter found Jesus compelling enough to follow. And so what was the difference between those who turned back and Peter and the others who were like, I don't get what's going on here, but I'm going to keep following? Why does the Jesus path compel some but not others? Well, I'd submit this, probably many reasons for that, but for one, for some, for these disciples that turned back, I would submit Jesus was an event to be witnessed, not a path to explore and follow. And of course, for me, stories of travel and hiking always are sort of the best way to make sense of it all. If you ask anyone who's visited the Grand Canyon about their experience there, you will no doubt be met with descriptive words like majestic and awe-inspiring and beautiful. In fact, to grasp the vastness of the Grand Canyon, it's almost beyond words, but it's fascinating to think that more people have stood on the moon than have traversed the entirety of the Grand Canyon. 12 people have been on the moon. Only 9 people have traversed the entire length of the Grand Canyon. It is such a feat. I was talking to Steve Martin the other day. He's been down in the canyon 3 times. It's just a life-changing event for him. And when people talk about the Grand Canyon as awe-inspiring and beautiful, well, of course, how could it not be? And yet, I'm going to sound crazy perhaps saying this, but in being honest with myself, if you were to ask me about my experience with the Grand Canyon, I would have to say it was a bit disappointing. It's entirely my fault, of course. I had only scheduled in but an afternoon to take in the majesty of the Grand Canyon. I didn't have time to explore, and that's precisely the point. Taking in the Grand Canyon is, of course, indeed breathtaking. In fact, when we were there, it's so vast that in one gaze, we could see 2 separate storm systems with lightning coming down and a rainbow over to our left. I mean, it was absolutely breathtaking. And yet, crowded as I was there at the visitor center taking this in with other people, the experience felt touristy, overrun, annoying. The Grand Canyon was something for me that first visit. It was something to check off my list. There, I've seen it, I've taken it in, and it was gorgeous. But again, when all you're asked to do is take something in, what you find at the Grand Canyon is that behind you are 100 buses and about 5,000 tourists, all of them with selfie sticks trying to get the same picture. And it's just not quite the same when you're crowded around the best spots, you could say, at the Grand Canyon. For me, in that moment, the Grand Canyon was a place, an event to witness, not explore. And because of that, I just didn't find it all that compelling, which is, I think, anathema in some ways. And I think, like my experience at the Grand Canyon, too often the Christian faith is presented to us as something to witness without exploring. It's something to take in rather than something that asks us to travel. And we're about, of course, to enter into the Advent, the Christmas season, which to me, the Advent Christmas season is about the Grand Canyon of the Christian faith, right? It's this massive event. It's a season that we're asked to pay witness to. So year after year, we stand on the edge of the rim of the Grand Canyon that is Advent and Christmas, and we take it in. But too often, it's just something that we pay witness to without exploring or traveling. And every year, no doubt, as we think about incarnation, there's something absolutely gorgeous and breathtaking about it. And yet, Christmas can feel a bit like my experience standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon with 4,000 other people behind me jostling to get that picture. It can feel crowded. It can feel overrun. And to be honest, not that magical when you're fighting your way through the mall. But the Jesus path was never designed to be something we just witness. It's a path that asks us to explore and to follow. And I think the difference between my experience at the Grand Canyon and my experience in a place called Buckskin Gulch might serve as a nice contrast. You see, it was a part tourist information center, part museum, and my good friend Riley and I, we wandered into it from a 42 degree Celsius heat. We began to peruse the exhibits there. And finally, we approached the front desk, and my friend Riley shyly asked, we've heard of this place called Buckskin Gulch, Slot Canyon. Can you tell us how to get there? And the woman behind the counter looked at the two of us with a bit of a puzzled glance. You two want to hike there? Yeah, yeah, we do. You're going to go like that? Sure. We were in shorts, t-shirts, and had on flip-flop sandals. And she said, you know it's dangerous out there, right? We did know, or at least we thought we knew. But we sort of turned, okay, what's your warning? Here are her warning. She said, you know, if you don't bring enough water with you, you can end up in serious trouble from dehydration. It's hot out there. And listen, sons, she says, flash floods can happen out there anytime. My friend Riley is a bit of a, well, he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. And he said, well, listen, if that happens, we'll just tread water until we reach the top of the canyon. The woman's voice grew hushed with us as she proceeded to scold and warn us. She said, son, that ain't gonna happen. She said, you're dead if a flash flood comes. She said, last year, two hikers were found in the gulch with their skin missing. Skin missing. She had my attention. What does that mean? You say, well, Buckskin Gulch is a 13-mile-long slot canyon. It's the biggest slot canyon, some people believe, in the entire world. And the thing about Buckskin Gulch is this. It's 13 miles long, and there's no in or out. Once you're in there, you either finish or you turn back. And what makes it so dangerous, why Backpacker.com names it one of the 10 most dangerous hikes in the U.S., it's because of that. There's only one way in, one way out. And once you're inside, go back, go forward, there's no exit points along the way. And so the woman said, if a flash flood comes, water can rise to 100 feet in 2 minutes. You'll be met with a wall of water. It will take you away. We said, but why had those two lost their skin? And she said, because the canyon acts like sandpaper, and as they were swept down the canyon, they had been bounced off the walls so many times they'd lost their skin. Whew. I didn't want to go. Not at all. I was more in a, I would like to bear witness to it. I'd like to take a peek over and see it, but I don't want to travel it. And in my defense, as we drove down the 9-mile dirt road to get to the trailhead, it didn't help that signs of flash floods were everywhere. Parts of the road just seemed to disappear. It also didn't help that, in my mind, I could see a rain cloud in the distance. Rain falling on parched desert landscape has to go somewhere, often into a slot canyon. And so I protested to Riley, caution should be our guide, and we should turn around. Riley persisted, though, countering that caution never gets you anywhere interesting. He's just generally annoying like that. And he reminded me that we had come to the Southwest not to just witness the beauty, but to explore and travel it. And so as his assistants won the day and we traveled through this barren, rocky landscape with a bottle of Gatorade each, traveled a few miles to get to where the canyon slopes down, we crawled down into it, hiked a few miles, and we encountered the only two people that we would see that day, a park ranger guiding another person through the canyon. And when she saw us, she said, "You two either must be local or loco." I said, "I don't know, what does that mean?" Slang in Spanish, apparently, for crazy. We said, "Well, we're not local." She said, "Be careful, boys. The wilderness out here isn't a game." We giggled nervously and carried on. We hiked and hiked, this constant sense of anxiety. Were we doing something stupid here? But about an hour and a half into the hike, there was this moment. Miles from anywhere, next to this large rock face, Riley spotted a canister. We opened it, and it contained a description of the 8,000-year-old petroglyphs on the rock wall that we had not yet noticed. And we gazed upon it in this 8,000-year-old petroglyph, simple drawing etched into stone of a hunter with his bow drawn, and then a trail leading to an elk around the corner. It was the first time I'd ever seen a petroglyph. And for some reason in that moment, it caught me. I felt this kinship with the human species. I felt as though I had taken my place in a long line of human ancestors who had come to the wilderness looking for something, some kind of life. And for this hunter 8,000 years ago, he came to the canyon looking for life, for sustenance, for food. Today, others come to the canyon looking for something different, perhaps some kind of vision or direction. Others looking for an adrenaline rush, excitement, drama, whatever the case. All of us in that canyon over thousands of years connected in our search for a spark of life. And for me in that moment, I couldn't explain why I was there. I wasn't sure exactly why I was there beyond simply feeling a compulsion to go. Like 8,000 years of history before me, I think I was just looking for a sign of life, and I had found it. And when you travel, whether it's the U.S. Southwest or any great, beautiful terrain, you can go to many places to witness and take in beauty, but if you want to find a spark of life, it requires risk, requires moving beyond the tourist trappings of hiking and deep, travel on a trail. And I think to find life on the Jesus path is similar. The Jesus path is not something to just bear witness to, but it's something to hike and travel and follow. This is what separated Peter, I think, from the legions of followers who decided to turn back. Bob Dylan for them, right? "Fare thee well, Jesus. This is too much. I'm moving on." But what Peter saw in Jesus was something different. What those others saw in Jesus was something to witness to. They're like, "Wow, look at this man. Take him in. Look at his teaching, his healings, his incredible miracles. What a thing to behold. What a thing to witness." But for Peter and others, Jesus represented the very presence of life. And so for Peter, Jesus wasn't something to just witness. Jesus was someone to follow. And when you find life and vitality, you don't witness it, you follow it. And that's what Peter and the others do. You know, I truly get why so many people don't find the Jesus path compelling today. I feel like for so many of us, Jesus has been presented as something to witness. But I think when that's all Jesus and his path become, it feels like a tourist trap. You might be able to sense the beauty, but all around us are these loud tourists and it's, Jesus is the presence of life and calls us to follow. Second question, though, how do we know when we've encountered Jesus on the path? You know, last week I mentioned that the Jesus path isn't absent its creator. Jesus' spirit travels with us. And that can sound mystic and strange, I think, but what do I mean by that? How do we know when we've encountered Jesus on the path? Well, there's a great story in the book of Luke, of course, of two followers who, listening to the Bob Dylan song, they're walking away themselves. It's the Road to Emmaus story. It sort of goes like this. They're walking to Emmaus, this town away from Jerusalem. They're leaving faith, you could say, behind, and And it happened that as they talked and debated, Jesus himself approached and journeyed along with them, but their eyes were constrained so as not to recognize him. Like this, Jesus plays the fool here as they walk and talk, comes in disguise. He's asking, what's going on? What's going on, travelers? So these disciples, they start telling Jesus all the things that have happened the past few days in Jerusalem. And then they say this line, we had been hoping that he was the one about to liberate Israel. And I love that line because it's just dripping in disappointment, right? That's why they're walking away from it all. They're disappointed with their faith. They'd gone in on the Jesus path, but it had ended in disappointment and crushed dreams. And as John mentioned earlier, there's so many today that that's exactly their experience. I went in on this Jesus path thing, and it just ended in disappointment. But then something happens. They approach the village to which they were journeying, and he, Jesus, made as if to journey further on. And they urged him intently, saying, stay with us. It's toward evening. This day has now set. And he went inside to stay with them, and it happened that as he reclined at the table with them, he took the loaf and blessed it, and having broken it, he shared it with them. And their eyes were opened. They recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. And they said to one another, was not our heart burning within us while he spoke to us on the road, as he opened up the scriptures to us? And rising up in that same hour, they returned to Jerusalem, found the 11 gathered together along with those who were with them, saying, the Lord truly has been raised and appeared to Simon. They related the things that happened on the road and how he had been recognized by them in the breaking of the bread. How do we know when we've encountered Jesus in life on the path? I find this really hard to put into words. It's something that has to find you even as you look for it, I would say. It's to find ourselves swept up in a drama not of our own choosing. To encounter Jesus on the path, I would say, is to find yourself in transcendent moments of awe and love and hope and peace. To follow the Jesus path is not to walk a trail that's absent its creator. But how do we know? How do we know we've encountered Jesus? I think this story is telling. And I don't think mysticism needs to be as strange as we make it out to be. We know we have encountered Jesus on the path when, like these disciples here, our hearts are burning within us. Whenever we meet moments or places or people that fill us with life in non-self-centered ways, divine presence is often close at hand. In my experience, those divine encounters are often quiet and subtle. And I want to tell you about a mystic experience I had this summer, and I really don't like telling these stories because they're weird and they kind of don't make sense. But I was in Banff again this summer, and as I've relayed to you before, I'm kind of obsessed with seeing bears in the wild. Whenever I'm out in Banff, I follow the daily bear report, trying to figure out where they are and then take the family hiking in that direction. And last summer it worked out. We saw a grizzly and three cubs on the trail. Luckily, there's like 11 of us, so power in numbers. But summers also for me are a bit of they're always a bit of an existential crisis for me. You know, I'm always like, what am I doing in life? And you know, I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Always have questions about myself in the summer. And so we had been hiking with the family, and I said to Kristen, I need to go on a solo hike. I need to go hiking on my own. She's like, why? What are you up to? I'm like, I'm trying to find a bear. And she thought I'm kind of an idiot, but make sure you take the bear spray. Okay. And I had been scouting, and I thought, okay, I think I have an idea. There's a hike in Banff called Surprise Corner. And the surprise is not a bear around the corner. The surprise is you hike out a couple miles, and then you come around this corner and surprise an incredible view. A meadow, a river, a mountain. And I thought that's where I'm going to go hiking. And I just had, again, I don't have a suicidal wish, I don't think. I'm like, I've got to go. And I wanted to encounter a bear. something about the power. Like, if there's one animal that's powerful in nature, it's a bear. And I had been talking and wrestling with God, like, I need an encounter, God. I need an experience. A bear would do the trick. I don't want to get eaten, but to feel that electric feeling of encountering power in nature, it would just, God, meet me at the meadow, God, in the form of a bear. And so I hike out, and it's getting toward dusk, and I got my hiking poles, and I'm terrified, so I'm clicking them. Hey, bear. I want to see it, not get too close to it. And I'm hiking. I come around Surprise Corner, and there's no bear, but there's this majestic river meadow. I start wandering around the meadow, talking out loud to God, and I want to see it, and I know it's silly. I know. This is why I hate sharing experiences like this. It's so ridiculous. I get it, but I'm like, I want to see a bear. Meet me. It's been an hour. I'm in this meadow on my own, and I've about given up. I'm sitting on the bank of the river, got my feet actually in the river, just taking it all in. I'm sitting there waiting for that moment of encounter, and I open my eyes and look across the river, and there is a deer. And I started chuckling to myself. A deer just looking at me. Chewing, looking at me. And I'll get into this later. The idea of, I always think there's an invitation between causality and coincidence. If you were to ask me, do I think God sent a deer to look at me? No, I don't think that. But I'm looking at this deer, and in that moment, my heart was on fire. And an invitation in that moment, because what it spoke to me is that I'm always looking for Jesus the lion, the big beast, Jesus of power, to show up and very clearly say to me, you're doing the right things, Brad, you're on the right path. And what I got was Jesus the lamb, the deer. And my heart was on fire because in that moment I thought, well, everything I have, all that I need is right here. And I was just filled with this tremendous sense of gratitude. Here I am in the mountains, and my family's with me, and I'm part of an amazing, incredible community. I don't know what it was, but in that moment, just seeing the deer, it was just one of those moments where you're always looking for power, aren't you, Brad? You're always looking for the God that might scare you a little bit. And what you get is just this deer, and I know it's silly. But in that moment, it did something to me. And that's always been my experience with divine mystic encounters. Those things that make our heart on fire. Sometimes it can be that movie or TV show you're watching, right? And you go to bed as a parent at the end of the night, I'm going to be a better parent tomorrow. Just your heart's on fire, right? I'm going to ask the band to come and share a song that John actually shared with me a couple years ago, and geez, I love this song. But divine encounters, meeting Jesus on the path, it's like these disciples, they recognize their hearts on fire, and so many different things do that for us. For some of us, it's justice work, right? Like, oh, I'm on fire right there. And anytime our hearts are on fire in a non-self-centered way, I think that's a moment of encounter, that's a moment of meeting Jesus on the path. And for me, those moments are often quiet and subtle. And yet a compelling longing rises within us. At once, everything makes sense, as we're overwhelmed by mystery and beauty. Sometimes we're convicted. These moments are fleeting, but to me, they're very real. And in the presence of something so compelling, you simply can't walk away. Like Peter, we sense we need to keep searching and exploring. And so I would say what the Jesus path wants to do for us is keep the light in our eyes on fire, ablaze. And this is a song by Alanis Morissette, who I believe is a poet and a prophet. This was written about her kids. This is Ablaze. Oh, thank you, Ben. That song is just, as a parent, How's that not our theme song? A parent's desire to keep a child's fire going. That's my mission with my kids now, since hearing that song. That, exactly that. And I believe the Jesus path is exactly the same. The God of the universe saying, I want to keep that light in your eyes ablaze. And any time on the Jesus path, we meet those moments where our hearts are on fire. We don't have to make it so confusing what it means to encounter the divine. It doesn't have to be so mysterious. Anytime we find and sense that life and vitality and our hearts are on fire because we want to give ourselves for others, you've met the divine. You've met the creator of the path on the trail. Divine encounters are often quiet and subtle. But this is the mission of the Jesus path, to keep us ablaze, to keep us from walking through life dull-eyed and dreary and half asleep to the gift that is life around us. That's the mission of Nexus, to help us do that. And so that's my hope for this series as we keep moving, that we would move beyond the freeways and tourist trappings of the Christian path and move beyond where the crowds often gather and move into something deeper. Follow the presence, follow the path, because I'm convinced there's a mystery, a beauty to the Christian faith that has to be seen and explored beyond the highway of skepticism. A path must be walked to find that which I'm speaking of. And beyond what you might know of the Christian path lies an ancient path that's more enchanting and compelling, I believe, than you can imagine. But one final question before we hit the trailhead next week. Who is this path for? Who's welcome on this path? Sound cliche, but you, me, and everyone. And unfortunately, we live in a world that loves to fetishize difference. Fetishize it. Relentlessly, we live in a world that forms us, join a team, join a side based on religious beliefs, ideology, political persuasion. I want to say this, though, truthfully, I don't know if I really care that too much what any of you believe. I do hope some of what follows in the series might influence that, but I honestly don't really care about your particular set of beliefs. And so I'd say this, if you're an agnostic or an atheist, but you still find this Jesus path intriguing, come, let's walk a while together. If you're a fundamentalist and think everything I say is heresy, but you're like, I just can't quite leave. All right, let's go. Let's keep walking together. If you're part of the LGBTQ community and think that this path forbids people like you from walking on it, I'll travel with you. I'll walk by your side. Let's go. If you hold a traditional ethic around marriage and sexuality and feel like, you know what, I've been left behind in these confusing times. Know this, I'm willing to walk with you as well. Let's travel together. If you're affirming, non-affirming, third way, welcome to the path. If you think gender is a social construct or a biological reality, there's a room on the path for all of us. If you vote left, if you vote right, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is that divides us, I'm convinced that this path is radically different. If you're pro-choice or pro-life, if you believe in hell or don't believe in hell, on this path there's room always for inclusion and dissent. And on this path there truly are no sides. There's no camps. All it takes is a common curiosity around Jesus and the path he's asked us to follow. And all it requires is to just start walking. And of course, like any path, like any trail, we are formed in the act of walking itself, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. That's still to come. For now, all you need to know is that this path is for you, for all of us. And moreover, I believe this path is compelling. And I hope you do too. And so here's the hiking plan. It's simple. I want to examine some of the most important events in Jesus' life in the weeks to come, from his birth in a cave manger to his baptism in a river, being tempted in a desert wilderness to transfiguration on top of a mountain, his death on the top of a rocky hill to his resurrection in a garden. I just want to showcase the moments, the key moments in Jesus' life, and showcase that they're not just events to be witnessed. They're not just ideas we're asked to believe about Jesus. All these events are metaphorically ones we're asked to walk and follow and enter into. To do so is to follow Jesus in his path. So let me simply say this. If you've come with me this far, I want to introduce you this year, over the next few months, to the path I call home, the path I call compelling. So as a community, let's start walking, and next week we begin with Jesus' birth. I'm going to ask Carla if she would come and close us in prayer, and then we can go about our day together. Thank you, Carla.